Hey y'all, we are so happy to be back for season 3, and I wanted to take a moment to jump in and say hi and give you a little bit of insight into what this season is going to be about. We have a handful of interviews that we're pretty excited about that'll be coming out over the next couple of months that are going to be showcasing how data and technology are having an impact in a couple of different domains. There's a particular emphasis on education this season. That's not actually intentional. It just kind of happened that way, but some really great perspectives to be able to share. And per usual, we'll be identifying some of the common threads that show up as far as data and technology goes in these different domains and what's unique too. So you can look for a new episode coming out every month. Before we dive in, I just want to take a moment to say thank you so much to Dr. Laura Latta. I am super pumped about this conversation. I think you will find that she is a gem, as anyone who has met her will think as well. So let's get into it.
Especially when you start to look at maybe broader political views, and we want, this is definitely not the content, you know, for this podcast, but
no one will ever come on the Simeo podcast ever again.
Oh my God.
That won't make it in the cut.
Hey y'all, welcome back to another episode of A Simeo Decoded. I'm Jess.
And I'm Aaron.
And we are thrilled. We have an excellent guest today, Dr. Laura Latta with the Tulsa Higher Ed Consortium. We're so thrilled to have you, Dr. Laura Latta, on our podcast so we can talk about data and the higher ed world and everything that you have to offer in that space. And I would love to start with you introducing yourself and what the consortium is.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Jess. I'm so excited to be here. My name is Dr. Laura Latta. I'm the executive director of the Tulsa Higher Education Consortium. The consortium is a collaborative of 9 colleges and universities and civic philanthropic groups in the Tulsa area. We're all working together to support student success and degree completion in higher ed in Tulsa.
You're so good at it. It took me like 7 years to get the elevator pitch down for Simeo. I don't even think I still have it down very well.
Man, the elevator pitch is so challenging. When you do a lot of work across a lot of spaces, yeah, it's wild.
And if you don't, like, in my experience, if someone's not in the space, like the word intermediary, let's just start there. Like, they just have no idea. It's like, what do you do? It's like, I mean, work with schools? Social good? Yeah.
We've kind of boiled it down to the 3 C's. So we say that we are a convener, a connector, and a communicator. And as a higher ed intermediary, if it falls in those buckets, we probably do it.
We love a good terminology conversation, and a note that it just is continually difficult sometimes to describe how different organizations and individuals show up in this space without sounding overly vague, especially for folks who work in broad capacity. So I just want to take a moment to point out how much I love Dr. Latta's description there, in case you didn't catch it, right? Convener, connector, communicator. Yes, high level, but also so apt. And we wear these hats a lot at Asemio too, and especially when we're working in more of our community data sharing initiatives. So love that. Probably going to borrow it. Anyway, it's just a great description about the higher ed consortium's role as an intermediary in a way that's really simple and easy to digest.
That's awesome. Okay, like I'm learning how to boil the story better.
It is tough. Tell us a little bit about your background. How did you get to the consortium?
Yeah, well, my journey is quite an interesting and winding road. I didn't grow up saying that I want to grow up to be an executive director of a higher education consortium. No. But I've always known. No, I didn't, believe it or not.
I want to know that kid out there that says that, though. I would totally be like, okay, let's go to coffee. Let's do a Zoom meeting and let you talk about your future.
Yeah, honestly, and before the Tulsa Higher Ed Consortium existed, I really didn't understand what a consortium did. So it makes a lot of sense that when I introduce myself and say Tulsa Higher Education Consortium, people say Tulsa Higher Ed what? And have to really explain that a consortium is a collaborative group. We're all working together to move in the same direction for the common good of students. But my background is 100% in education. So I actually started my career as a fourth grade teacher. And I've actually taught every grade in elementary school. So I've taught kindergarten and first grade and gifted and talented education. And I just love education so much. I kept going to school. I got my bachelor's in early childhood education and then decided to get my master's in administration. And the more that you learn about education in the system, the more that you realize you don't know. I think that's sort of how everything is. The more you learn, the more you realize you don't know. And I just wanted to figure out the systems and the structures, and now it's sort of become a lifelong pursuit. But I got my master's and then my doctorate, both again in education, and I started teaching college courses at the University of Oklahoma. I've taught for about 7 years. I teach early childhood math. And I really have just enjoyed so much working with college students. And that was really my doorway into working with higher education. So after I got my doctorate, I decided to make a change from K-12 education into higher ed. And I actually started working for a nonprofit here in the Tulsa area as the director of post-secondary partnerships and research. And I started working with colleges and universities. And one of the projects that I was on was something called the Tulsa Transfer Project, which ultimately led to the formation of the Tulsa Higher Education Consortium. And then one thing led to another. I applied for the role as executive director, and here I am. And if I could have gone back and known when I was a kid that consortium executive director was a job I could do, I probably would have wished that I could do it, because it's the best job in the world. And I'm so happy and so fulfilled and love the work that I get to do every day.
Getting your PhD, you have like some probably access to areas that you didn't have before. I'd love to hear a little bit about what that journey was like. And also, what did you do your dissertation?
I love learning. And I kind of just started going to school and didn't stop until I reached the terminal degree. And then after I finished the degree, had sort of like an identity crisis. Like, now what? I don't go to class? But
that's why you started teaching.
That's right.
Collect more degrees, you know?
Oh, man. I loved my experience getting my doctorate, and it wasn't necessarily something that I always set out to do, but you're right, Erin, when you have that title and, you know, as a woman in higher education spaces, for better or for worse, having those letters behind my name do allow me in spaces to have conversations about, you know, making systemic change. And what do you want me to tell you about that? I can tell you about my dissertation.
Yeah, but I'm curious, like, because the dissertations I've found have a range of accessibility. Some that it's like, okay, I just don't even know what any of the words mean. And then some are like fairly accessible for someone that didn't do like studying that field. So I'm curious as where you went with it.
Yeah, mine was very accessible. So at the time, this was when I started my dissertation, was 2018. And this is wild. I think back on this time in my life and I'm like, how did I have so much energy? But I was part-time community school coordinator, part-time graduate assistant, and was teaching classes and taking classes at the same time, taking doctoral classes, teaching bachelor's degree classes. And so I had to do a dissertation that lent itself to all the work I was already doing. So like I said, I was a community
efficient
school coordinator. And I thought for a long time, because my research interests are about like dual language acquisition. I thought I was going to do something on dual language acquisition. I wrote a couple articles in, you know, along that research line, but my dissertation ultimately was over STEM out-of-school time programs and how they support 21st century skills and STEM attitudes. So I did an analysis of, we had, at the time I was a community school coordinator at a community school here in Tulsa. We had 250 kids that were participating in out-of-school time programs. We had like 30 different out-of-school time programs. Incredible community groups. We had like tinkering clubs and coding clubs. And then we also had groups like storytelling and writing and creative, you know, different artistic expressions. And actually,
I
want to
go to that school like so bad. It sounds so fun.
Sign me up. I want to do that now.
Yeah, same. Like, I want that to, can we just make that be like, I want a tinkering time for some.
Oh, it was beautiful. It still is beautiful. And it's a public school. That's the cool thing. I mean, the power of community schools and public schools and supporting students. And it was like the school bell rang at 3 o'clock, but then a whole new school day began. And it was the school day that kids got to pick and like lean into their interests and pursue their talents. And so it was a mixed methods study. So there were quantitative data pieces and qualitative data pieces. So I looked at teachers' lesson plans and students' experiences and student interviews and parent interviews. And I looked at survey data just to see what was the experience like for students, and actually found that no matter what the program, students' STEM attitudes were impacted in a positive way. And so I'm such a proponent of high quality out-of-school time programming, STEM programs, and also art and creative expression programs. It's just so life-giving for students to be able to have that space and time to really pursue their interests with their peers and with a teacher that's really passionate about the content that they're teaching. Because so often, you know, public education has so many standardized facets to it where you know, as a teacher, I remember having to teach certain things because that was the requirement, that was the standard. But then the school they ended, and I did teach after school time programs too, or out of school time programs. And it was like, all right, now the fun begins.
Okay, we have to pause for a second just to highlight this phrase that Dr. Latta keeps saying, life-giving, which is just so, so beautiful. And as a former educator, her, not me, that is, I hear, you all probably hear her voice just light up when she's talking about these after-school programs being when the day truly started, and that as an educator, your true joy comes from seeing students getting to engage with what sparks joy and instills confidence in them. And when we work with our clients and our technology solutions allow individuals like Dr. Latta and others to spend less time sifting through information or doing the administrative tasks and can spend time with their students or their clients and not as much time just mired in the administrative burden of paperwork, digital or otherwise. That is part of the magic of our work, but an important part of it.
Our family is multilingual. And we're not just multilingual, we're also multimodal in the sense that one of our languages is sign language. So American Sign Language between my daughter and my wife, and then my wife and I speak Russian Sign Language, and then the daughter and I speak English, right? So but there was a lot of people commenting about dual language acquisition around me. So I'm curious if you can give a headline about what is known or what interests you about that, like some of, you know, it's just a topic that I'd love to hear you kind of like wave top a little.
The interest really sparked because I'm a monolingual person, but I was a teacher in a classroom where 17 of my 24 students were learning multiple languages simultaneously. And this was when I was teaching kindergarten. So when, before the age of 6, kids are considered a dual language learner because they're not only learning the language that's most prevalently spoken in the home, but also could be learning the language at school, which in my case was English. So I had students that spoke Spanish at home. They spoke just a variety of different languages. And I wanted to continue that language development at school, but I didn't know how to do that as a monolingual, you know, English speaker. And so inviting family into the classroom and inviting language and learning the language myself so that I could empathize with that process. I'm not fluent, but I have learned a lot about the different languages that my students spoke because I didn't want that language acquisition to end.
Y'all, I have chills. She's amazing. I wish I had more educators like her in my life growing up.
I wanted it to continue in the classroom. And it's such a precious window of time, especially that 3 to 5 age window, because there are so many in the brain, there's so many connections being made, that language acquisition is a lot easier for young children. And they're learning how to speak, read, write, and listen. All of that's happening at the same time. Like, the brain from the age of 3 to 5 is just like on fire, making these incredible connections and as students are communicating. And so that really just ignited the interest. I did a study of my classroom to see how my instructional practices could support their language development and how I could be more inclusive and more supportive. And so that's really the direction that my research took me.
When I was working internationally, one of my projects was to create a system for teaching another language. So I think they're like, I also am fascinated with language and culture, like the intersection mm-hmm. of language and culture. So the idea that you're thinking about your perspective as someone who is monolingual and then also how that influences your students and how you can create a more supportive and energizing environment, like with that myriad of like dynamics there, is so interesting. So it's just mm-hmm. fun and cool. And thanks for being interested in culture and language. I think more people should be.
Yeah.
Does it feel like you've done a lot of different things? When you talk about your journey, it seems like they're very different perspectives and experiences. Like, but does it feel like that? And how do you thread it together in your role today?
When I sit and I think about all of the roles that I've been able to hold in education, because I've been a teacher, I've been a community school coordinator, I've been, you know, director in nonprofit spaces. I do feel like a lot of ground has been covered. I heard the metaphor of the dance floor and the balcony, and I feel really privileged that I've gotten to experience both. Like, I've been on the dance floor doing the work, experiencing the struggles and challenges of being a teacher and an administrator, and then also being on the balcony and looking over on the dance floor, thinking more strategically about how could we improve the system so that it better benefits the students and the teachers and everybody within the system. So yeah, I've enjoyed getting to have both of those perspectives. And I think it's informed every role that I've had along the way. I will never, ever be able to forget my experiences as a teacher. And it truly does help me in my decision-making today as sort of more of a systems leader.
Well, and as the father of a fourth grader, seems like an amazing age. It's so fun. If I was going to teach, I don't think I would do well in the classroom. I'm not going to lie. I've been adjacent, you know, I've had a lot of, you know, been in communities where I was very close friends with teachers in international work. But if I had to, fourth grade would probably be where I would love to land.
It's the best grade. I think in elementary, it is such a fun grade to teach because students are old enough that they're figuring out their identities and who they want to be and making decisions about like their personas that they adopt. It's such a fun, and they still really love their teachers.
Yeah, I still remember I would give my teacher, I think second to fourth grade, like I was still going and give them a hug. I would just like run in and be like, oh, hi, you know, there's one specific second grade teacher, Ms. DeVries, that, you know, is not with us in the world anymore. And I remember she made such an impact on me when I turned like 19 or 20. I tried to find her just to say, like, hey, you really made a big impression on me in a way that shaped me for the rest of my life. She had already transitioned at that point. So that was kind of sad that I wasn't able to give her that. And it just made me respect more the impact that teachers have in the world that you don't know necessarily. Like, you could just be having a normal, quote, year and moving on. But then, you know, a couple of decades from there, there could be someone that's doing something in the world that you helped shape and foundationally in a way that has impact far beyond you would ever know. So it's an amazing profession.
Yeah, I've been really fascinated because I've worked in the education system and then nonprofit and then been adjacent to like more private industry. And I really think that teachers can do any job. They're amazing, incredible. They are required to wear so many different hats. And if you were to quantify and attach a dollar amount to every job that a teacher is required to fill in the course of a day, easily six figures. And so I think,
no doubt,
I will always and forever be advocating for teacher compensation because they make miracles happen.
Absolutely. You mentioned, you know, you're adjacent to some of the private industry. And I think we've had some interesting conversations about what makes the Tulsa Higher Ed Consortium unique. Can you talk a little bit about the relationships that you've been developing in the community and then how that differs from other consortium models? Because that was something that was really fascinating for me to learn is that there are many consortia all over the U.S. and you all have a different style and flavor. And I think that would be really cool to highlight.
Absolutely. So our consortium has 9 colleges, including College of the Muscogee Nation, Northeastern State University, OSU Tulsa, OU Tulsa, Rogers State University, Tulsa Community College, University of Tulsa, Southern Nazarene University, Tulsa, Langston University. So we have this really cool constellation of colleges and universities that really run the whole spectrum of, we've got a tribal institution. We've got the only HBCU in the state of Oklahoma, the largest community college. It is an incredible group of colleges and universities that are committed to students.
I really want to highlight the amazing work that Dr. Latta, Dr. Wyatt, and the whole team at the Higher Ed Consortium has done to really foster trust among their member institutions and other community partners. As you might imagine, in many communities, this is difficult because it's just frankly difficult to get large groups of people to come together for a common purpose for a number of reasons. And trust, or lack thereof, is often one of those reasons, what makes it very challenging.
And we, when the consortium was formed, the leaders of those institutions said, you know, it's really critical, number one, that we take into consideration how other consortia were formed. So they very intentionally brought in other consortia. There's about 60 across the nation. Most of them are concentrated along the East Coast, but listened very intently to, you know, what does a consortium do and what would that look like in Tulsa? And it became really obvious to the leaders that were launching the consortium that having the voice of business, industry, philanthropy for our context was really important. And that is extremely unique. I have not found another consortium that also includes members from those groups. So we've got, you know, the city of Tulsa as part of our membership, the Broken Arrow and Tulsa Chambers, the Oklahoma State Regions, Impact Tulsa, and then 2 foundations, Tulsa Community Foundation and Schusterman Family Philanthropies. And so having those voices at the table really creates this opportunity for higher education and degree pursuit and attainment to be a citywide initiative and a citywide supported endeavor. So that makes us really unique, that we are not only higher education institutions, but also civic, philanthropic, and business. We're also the only consortium in the state of Oklahoma. When we formed, the group did a community-wide survey across the Northeast Oklahoma region, asking folks about their perceptions of higher education. And it became really obvious that a lot of folks actually didn't know what degree programs that our institutions offered. And believe it or not, across our 9 institutions, there are 425 different degree programs. So the opportunities for students are endless. What's more is that we have a lot of incredible businesses in the local area. And we found when we surveyed the community that businesses weren't always recruiting from these incredible institutions. They were looking out of state. Maybe they were recruiting from their alma mater, or maybe they'd identified a college or university that they were familiar, had a program that aligned with the roles they were looking for. But since we formed and launched, we've been able to say, here are the programs. So on our website, TulsaHigherEd.com, we have a degree directory where people can see which institutions offer which programs on which campuses, not only so that students can identify and make decisions about where they want to go to college, but so that businesses can target their recruitment efforts. And that's been really incredible to match the supply of talent and the demand of the workforce and sort of serve as that matchmaker role. We've been able to really highlight those businesses that are recruiting talent from our institutions and investing in their employees to earn a degree or to upskill or get an additional degree. So the existence of the consortium hasn't just impacted students, but also the relationships of higher ed and business and industry as well.
And keeping talent in the community and helping the community grow too. Like, there's certainly an economic benefit too that's sustaining. So you kind of see this really awesome spiral up of benefits that touches a lot of different parts of the community. Wave your magic wand. What does the future look like? What do you hope to see in, you know, 5, 10, 20 years? Like, what does the consortium look like?
More connectedness between the systems. So K-12, higher ed, and business and industry really supporting one another to help students navigate decisions about their futures, starting from elementary, middle, high school, and then understanding and knowing very early on where they want to go and earn their degree and ultimately transition right into a job where they have the right skills, they have the right talents for whatever job that they want to do. So I think that really just more connectedness across those systems would be the dream.
Yeah. Well, what do you think is the biggest gap to that today? There is really some hypotheses, but
K-12, higher education, workforce, many of them are powered by different systems that maybe use different ways of measuring things. They have different definitions of what success looks like. And so that mismatch in systems and definitions creates some barriers between them. I think that's the greatest thing, but there's certainly probably a few more things as well.
This is a pattern that is generalizable beyond higher education, like justice involvement, human services,
basic needs.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Basic needs. Exactly. Like, wherever you go, there's this constant realization of, wow, you know, super resourced communities, right? Still aren't, like, it feels like you're trying to claw your way up a hill and you're sliding 2 feet backwards for every inch that you make forward. And there's this idea of enhanced collaboration and connectivity. And I think of, like, a reduction in friction and an increase in agility and movement towards these, you know, outcomes that can be hard to grasp. And so this wickedness of the problems that we're dealing with is, like, resistant because of those institutional and systemic, like, constraints to that. And I'm curious what, if you have instincts on the best, like, systemic level, either patterns, interactions, or strategies to reduce that friction and or somehow align across those, because I think that's still an open question that every, either if you're consortium or collaborative or however you define your community coming together to solve or work towards, you know, enhancing an outcome or solving this problem. I think that's everyone's trying to answer that question.
Think about, you know, higher education operates on semester timelines. So, you know, half chunks of the year, basically. Whereas business industry really operates on quarterly. They move a lot faster. They accomplish things at a faster rate. And I use the phrase like, so sometimes they don't know how to speak the same language in terms of even just timelines and deadlines and what is the norm for accomplishing an objective in one system is very slow or very fast for the other. There's also different languages used. And so you almost need like this Rosetta Stone to interpret what do you mean by 21st century skills, or phrases like professional skills, soft skills, and then how can we apply that in higher education and embed that in coursework that students really could use some direct instruction around those types of things. I don't have the solution, but I think there's a lot of dispositions that need to be taken into consideration, like an openness to work together. So I think that's the first thing, just the possibility that we can work together in a way that's really meaningful and create some seamless flow from one system to another. And then when there's that openness, having champions that are willing to investigate and learn about the other systems so that you can make connections to whatever system you're in. So if you're in K-12 and you're preparing students for higher education, really understanding what are the deadlines in higher education versus what are the deadlines in K-12. So I think about things like college applications and FAFSA. Like if your timelines are off or if your definitions are different, but you're using the same words, it can be very frustrating. And when folks encounter frustration, it's very easy to just throw your hands up and want to say it's impossible. Another example that I've been thinking of, so the consortium recently got a federal HUD grant to support students experiencing homelessness. And our team has had to learn a different system. So housing has a lot of other metrics that we are very unfamiliar with. And it is very daunting to learn a whole new system, but it's worth the pursuit and it's worth persevering to learn that system and then figure out how it can be applied to higher ed, because there are students that are experiencing homelessness, and that's the barrier that's keeping them from getting that degree and then unlocking the next level of opportunity for themselves.
Like, do we need 1,000 coffees every single month to, you know, constantly stay up to date on the language? Because the problem is even if you learn the language in a domain, then you have to get to a community, then you have to get to domain within that community, and then executive directors, other leaders change. And so you have different levels of that. And it almost seems like you need like an emergent Rosetta Stone across every domain, like in real time. And so we've actually been thinking about how can you create emergent taxonomies and these like decoders that just kind of understand where someone is coming from and then maps that across what they're wanting, like looks at their intent and their meaning behind what their goal is and then maps it to another domain. But that's like, I know it sounds super abstract, but a really concrete example is if you have a knowledge management system, and let's say you're a program leader or direct services provider or community member that's interested in, I've heard that kids aren't getting to school as much as they should be. And I can't remember what that's called, but I'm going to go to this portal and say like, why aren't kids getting to school? I'm interested in learning more about this. But then you have a researcher that comes in and says like, show me, I'm looking for research on the correlation between, you know, ACE scores and chronic absenteeism, right? And then you have a philanthropist that comes in and says, you know, I wonder what the return on investment is on, you know, out of school time providers. But like how you resolve those different perspectives in real time without having to have manual intervention or someone that's constantly being a translator is like still an unsolved problem in our society. And I don't think until we can ease that friction, I don't think we're going to be able to make a lot of movement around wicked problems, just because they're going to advance faster than we can like claw after them in real time.
I think that's an incredible point. And having that learning management system, to your point about turnover, that is a huge challenge that we have, that across 9 institutions, there's turnover that happens just naturally, and attrition, and you know, folks retiring and things like that. But having that compendium, having that source of information that can continue no matter what the dynamics or situations and people movement, I think that could be really empowering, and I think that's incredible.
We've been teasing apart the role of centralization in systems level, like, change work, and we're frankly forming some pretty, like, loosely held strong opinions, right? And one of those is, I think that the, you know, control of data should be decentralized. Like, the domains, the institutions should hold and control their data, their information, and the access to that, and the uses. And that's, you know, there's a lot of reasons behind that, around political will and trust and collaboration, to governance and privacy and security, all the way to technical arguments to be made on why that's better. But then, so decentralization of domain data ownership and control, those data need to be pulled together to make, you know, data informed, actionable, like, insights and decisions. So you have to, there's some federation in there, but then I think that we should centralize this knowledge around our community and who's working on what, and what we call things, and that can be centralized. So we've started to, like, advance our understanding of where you centralize versus decentralize or federate culture, governance, and technical infrastructure. And I think that will help us advance against these wicked problems more easily and quickly.
This may surprise you, but technologists have a lot of opinions, and they're not always the same. And when it comes to different data management approaches, coming down to the question of whether a centralized versus a federated approach is better, you're definitely going to find two camps. I will say we absolutely skew towards a federated data approach. However, I will caveat and say that there is a time and a place for both. So it's nuanced. There are definitely circumstances in which one is better than the other. But I'll give you here in a moment just a brief overview of the two different types, just so you have that framing if you're not already familiar with the differences between the two approaches. And then that'll just give you a little bit of insight into these opinions. So, given that, a centralized data management approach is where your data is stored and managed from a single location or a database. So this is great for enabling consistent data handling practices. It can sometimes simplify data governance, and it really simplifies the management process overall, because all of your data-related operations, backups, updates, and things like that, they're happening in one place. But this is a two sides, one coin situation, because that also introduces risks like the fact that you have a single point of failure. So, you know, the whole ship can go down if it's compromised. On the other hand, a federated data management approach involves managing and accessing data from multiple places or autonomous databases. There's no physical consolidation. So this is great for enabling different departments or organizations in particular to maintain control over their own data, while still enabling it to be shared and accessed and used as part of a larger data set. So this is great for scenarios where data can't be centralized because of privacy or regulatory reasons, and it can really help with data accessibility. But, you know, there are also cons. There can be some complexity in terms of data integration and querying and things like that. So hopefully that gives you a little bit of insight into these two different approaches, and now you can probably see why we skew towards a federated approach.
You talked a little earlier about the data dashboard and some of the work that is happening, you know, specifically that the IR community of practice is doing. But share your thoughts on the value of using data and you know, kind of what does that look like to help advance some of the goals that you have as a consortium?
Yeah, so the value of shared data helps us understand how our collaboration together is moving the needle for students. There isn't currently, or there wasn't before our formation, a space where we could go and look at student trends in enrollment, persistence, transfer, and completion for Northeast Oklahoma. And so when the consortium was launched, our KPIs, our key performance indicators, are to support student success and degree completion. If we don't know what degree completion looks like in our region, then we don't know if what we're doing is making a difference to impact that outcome. And so the institutional research community of practice has really done so much work together to figure out how to share data in a way that helps to inform work that we're doing, make sure that we're communicating to students in the best way, make sure that recruitment efforts are making a difference, that we're investing in the right approaches to help students navigate their journeys. We have about a 50-50 split in our student population between students who are newly graduated from high school and adult learners. And those two groups of students need very different supports on their higher education journeys. Often, you know, adult learners have jobs, they have families, they have homes, they have lots of life obligations and responsibilities, and understanding their journey and what are some supports that are needed is just as critical and just as crucial as understanding the journey of fresh out of high school, first year, college, like 19-year-old student. And so it's really helped inform us about supporting those different types of students.
Even just aligning on what's most important from a KPI perspective, like it can be a slog, right? I mean, there's a lot of detail and nuance, and when you bring multiple partners together, it can be a lot. What do you think is keeping folks at the table? Like, what do you feel is the most energizing aspect of the work? Because it doesn't always happen like quickly. You don't always see the fruits quickly, especially when you're first starting out.
That's a really good question. So what's keeping everyone at the table in terms of data sharing and having these conversations about student success? So if it's all right, I think I'm going to describe the sort of transfer journey, and I think that might get to the answer. So, you know, students who are navigating transfer, they start at an institution, maybe get an associate's degree at an institution, and then they make a decision about where they're going to go next. Well, if they haven't been counseled about the classes that they need to take, they could potentially transfer to a college and have taken classes at their previous institution that don't count towards their degree. So they've wasted time, they've wasted money, and they've also probably wasted some emotional, motivational energy, and it just is running out because it's deeply demotivating to transfer from an institution and find out that all of this incredible work that you've done, all of this learning doesn't even matter in that transfer process. So what happens is students become demotivated and they leave their degree programs prematurely. So you've got people out there that are maybe a couple semesters away from a bachelor's degree, but they just didn't finish because it got too hard. And this, you use the word slog, it was too much of a slog. And so our institutions, and really that was the formation of our collaborative efforts back in 2017, 2018, was to create a student experience that is seamless, where students are not losing resources, and where they are persisting to the completion of the degree. So I think it's really this holistic desire across institutions to ensure that from start to finish, whatever a student's journey is, whether, you know, it's starting at a four-year institution or it's starting at TCC and then transferring, that that pathway and that process is as seamless and barrier-free as possible. I think that's the motivating factor that keeps people coming to the table.
I was just going down memory lane a few decades back to high school, and I remember there was this some sort of degree type. I don't remember, it was like an honors or advanced something that literally no one cared about after high school. But at that point in time, I was trying to check boxes and I was like, oh, cool. So, but I didn't have, like, no one had told me that I needed a certain number of years of foreign language until it's too late for me to have the years of foreign language. And so I'm sitting there as, you know, a junior, or it must have been my junior year because I couldn't get enough in just my senior year. And someone mentioned this and I was like, but I took all these classes like specifically for this degree type. And then I had to go do summer school and do French with actually an amazing French teacher who's the mom of my best friend. Shout out to Mrs., you know, Karen Carell there. And like, it was so demotivating. Like, to your point, I was sitting there, you know, taking time and energy. I could have traded off one of my other classes for a French class easily. And it just was such a small version of what you're talking about, which was not impactful later in life. But to imagine being on your higher ed journey and a trajectory that's going to affect your entire career later in life and having that demotivation would be super motivating as a community to solve, so that we don't have our adult learners and our, you know, recent graduates coming in and struggling with that.
Well, and there's fairly simple solutions. And because we've all been at the table together and we've been willing to collaborate, something as simple as TCC has added to their application, do you intend to transfer? So from the moment that a student is going to TCC, TCC knows, okay, they have this intent to transfer and they're thinking about maybe transferring to NSU or RSU or any of our transfer receiving institutions. And they can counsel them along the way so that they're supporting them in taking the right classes that are going to lead to their ultimate goals. There are these two terms when you start to talk about how data influences the way that you function as an organization: data-informed and data-driven. And I think that a lot of folks get used to saying one over the other, and there's not always intention behind it. But we were just talking about how interesting languages like that, we're going to, you know, as a team, many of us jump on that and we're like, oh, you know, we have some opinions about one over the other, and kind of exploring the nuance of these two different terms. And I'm curious, one, if you lead with one over the other as a consortium, and two, just what are your thoughts about the different uses? Do you hear opinions about data-informed versus data-driven perspectives? And kind of what are your general thoughts about that? Yeah, that's a great question. So data-informed versus data-driven. When I was in training to become a teacher, data-driven was a phrase that was used so much that I stopped understanding really what it meant. It was data-driven instruction, data-driven. And then it wasn't until I started my research that I saw the connection of, you know, data-driven is really based on like inputs and outputs. So you do X, you get Y. You do more of X, you get more of Y. It's very formulaic. You measure everything. And the idea is that you change your behavior based on the output that is the result. The thing about data-driven decision-making is that it's not considerate of the nuance of human nature. So
couldn't agree
people
more.
Are dynamic. You know, data informed takes into consideration the human experience that, you know, not always if X happens, Y is going to be the result. So for example, I think about students maybe taking a test. College students that are preparing for an exam, or a high school student that's preparing for, a standardized test, an entry test. The idea of data driven is like, if you study, then you'll do good on the test. But the data informed is like, there's the consideration that if you're in a very difficult phase of life, that's going to impact your outcome on the test. If you had something to eat before you took the test, that's going to affect your physiological ability to perform well on that test. So data-informed pulls in more than just that output data and is considerate of experiences, biases, everything that makes the human experience the human experience, and adds that color so that you can say, yes, data is a very important factor that we're going to take into consideration when we're making decisions about, you know, if we're going to try a program or we're going to, you know, use an intervention here. But data inspired is just so much more inclusive of all of the factors that contribute to our day-to-day lives. I'm not sure that that was the best answer.
No. Well, I think it was amazing. Great.
I mean, it was highly aligned to how we think about it too, because as an organization that works so closely with data and sees some of the challenges about data entry, and those challenges range from, you know, is there alignment with what it means to, you know, even a single field, does everybody have the same shape in their head about what that actually means? Is there good workflow? Is it consistent? Is it comprehensive? Is it influenced by bias? Is it, you know, does it take into all the context that you suggested? And the answer is in large part, no, right? I mean, it's very difficult. And that's one of the reasons why I think there's such a growing interest in community data sharing too, right? Because each organization has one perspective and some have broader perspectives than others, but it's almost impossible to just rely on data alone. It would be, in our opinion, you know, in many cases, folly to do so. And that nuance that you talk about is so important. You know, it often ends with a, well, it depends. And nobody wants that answer, right? Because then you don't have clarity and direction. And folks, you know, I think there's a hunger to have an answer, right? But that's not how it works. So humans are just so dynamic and the work is complex. And so you really can't indefinitely, you know, with full confidence say that if I do this, then the outcome is going to be predictable, because there's just too many factors at play.
Yeah. And that is so annoying to so many technologists, because technologists and engineers want deterministic answers. Like, just tell me what you want X to be so I can solve for Y. Like, or tell me what you want Y to be so I can solve for X. And that's just not how it works. And one of my favorite roles that I find myself playing is when technologists that are hitting social impact domain coming from the private sector need to, you know, expand their understanding of the messiness of humans and how that impacts technical design. Because too often, like, one of the gripes I have about data driven, and again, people have good intent. It's not like people are, when they're using these terms, I don't think that people are saying that we need to autocratically have some, you know, technocracy that's, you know, where we're driven only from data. There's maybe a handful of people in the world that are going to like say that, but most people don't really think that, but they just mean we need to think more about the scientific part of things in a sense. And that doesn't leave, I totally agree with your perspective, that doesn't leave as much room, and it puts the focus different on the messiness and the social part of these processes. Whereas data informed or data inspired, or like setting data in not the primary place in the process, leaves room for the human side of it. And I believe that science and human story have to come together to form a knowledge basis for truth. And if you don't bring those things together, then that's, you know, you're heading down the wrong path. And that's not just an abstract philosophical concept. It's something that if you're building knowledge management systems, you got to kind of have figure out how you're foundationally pulling together your knowledge.
And two, aligning on what you mean even by the word data. To some, data has a very specific definition. I have been quoted as saying that everything is data, even, you know, and I'm a mixed methods researcher, so I love quantitative data and can, you know, do a statistical analysis until the cows come home. But also there's that qualitative, the experiential, the story that helps to, it, you know, add to the quantitative data. And so having both of those, I think, is really important. And I think there tends to be, especially in research communities, depending on the community, a preference of one type over the other. But I think if we can get to a space where we say both are data and both can inform the decisions that we're making, it can be really empowering, because then you're not just only looking at numbers, but you're looking at numbers and story.
Now, like, Jess, I think I have an idea for our next t-shirt, because we're always talking about t-shirts at a simulate, like, we like cool t-shirts. So we have one that says data base, but it's BAES, right?
Play
there. And now, like, maybe one of the things we can put on the list for an idea is what isn't data, Like,
ooh.
I think that would be a great, I would love to walk down the street and have someone stop me and be like, let's talk about that. I was like, all right, let me bring out my microphone. Let's go.
Is there anything that I haven't touched on yet?
You know, maybe just the acknowledgement of how much expertise lives at our colleges and universities and the importance of honoring that expertise. We have incredible lines of research that are happening in our backyards, and the researchers are busy doing the research, not always sharing that incredible research. So the consortium has really tried to amplify and shine a spotlight on some, you know, of that incredible work. And then also, you know, our institutional researchers, and really everyone is doing so, they're working together in such beautiful ways and hold so much expertise. And I just want to express appreciation for everyone in education that's making this system function, making it work for students, trying to improve it. I think this is amazing. I just want to say thank you so much for joining us. This was such a great conversation, and we're so appreciative and honored that you wanted to spend your time talking with us and to join the podcast. And we're so excited to see what happens as the consortium continues to grow and do great work in our community. And I'm just very grateful for the expertise that you bring and that you help, you know, Harvard and with the other institutions.
Yeah. And I would do like a 3-hour dinner party with you any day. Like any day. Like, so fun. I feel like we could talk. I wanted to off-road on so many topics you were talking about that wouldn't even be related to podcasts. So I'm looking forward to our coffee.
Yeah. No, I love that. I'm so excited. And I'm so honored. I'm the one that's honored when you reached out and shared this opportunity. I was like, really? Me? Are you sure? Did you ask the right person? Did you put the right Laura in the subject line or the recipient line? But thank you so much. And like, anytime we can collaborate, I'm 100% on board.
Amazing. Same.